Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to Musicals with Cheese, a podcast where I try to get Andrew to like musical theater more. And today is a very special episode. It is completely unlike anything we've done before, and I'm super excited.
We're just straight doing an interview.
Yeah, we're joined by Edward W. Hardy, a violinist, composer, very famous for The Woodsman, which is now on Broadway HD, and he's also doing a bunch of tours and a bunch of 54 and below visits. He's incredible, and I'm sure y'all already know who he is, so let me not introduce him anymore. Edward, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm just going to start the questions first and foremost. We're basically going to go down a chronological version of your life. Tell us a little about you, your background history, and what got you into music.
What got me into music? So I started when I was 7 years old. I'm a part of something called Opus 118. There's actually a movie about it called Music of the Heart, where Meryl Streep played my teacher, Roberta Gaspar. But I was in public schools, and there weren't any funding for music or violins. And violins were the only thing that were available at the time. So I gave up acting and dancing and chess club, mathematics club. I was in a lot of things trying to stay busy to start music. So I kept on playing this entire time, from that to Juilliard to getting my master's degree and doing off-Broadway plays. You know, it's funny because at Purchase College for my undergraduate, that's when I started composing music for plays. And I realized that the only way to really understand structure of a play or musical is to write music for the play that didn't have music. That would be a lot of Shakespeare plays. That would be a lot of August Wilson plays. One of the first musical-esque plays I've done was called Mother Courage, that incorporated a lot of music, kind of like The Woodsman, but wasn't necessarily considered a musical. But yeah, that's kind of how it all started. Was in school.
Now, did you find it hard to, like, start up in musical theater early on, or did you find it really easy to, like, fall into it?
Actually, it was quite difficult. Being classically trained, it was, I guess, musical theater almost seemed inferior to opera, which is very bad to say and kind of silly now that I think about it. Because we weren't experienced to it. You know, there was no invitation to go and see a musical or that we had to even study them. So it was very much you play orchestral music and chamber music, and then you're in a pit of an opera. And then the first time that happened for me was very magical. And I started to realize how beautiful storytelling is beyond just the musical aspect of it. Now, of course, an opera, it can have almost a tacky-ish production or can have like phenomenal, you know, musicians and actors, but musicals ended up telling it in a different way that was very touching and made it feel more personal to the audience, or at least to me, more so than an opera that's in a different language that's hard to understand.
What would you say the difference between an opera and a musical really is? It's always something I've struggled with a little bit.
Sure. I think that it's much more concentrated on the musical aspect than anything else. I think, it's very much with an opera, it's about the composer and maybe their previous works that they're trying to relate the music to, or whatever story that they are trying to bring to light while adding themselves entirely in it. But I don't really know what the biggest difference between an opera and a musical is. That's what I'm still trying to figure out myself. There's
a lot of musicals
that I love.
Yeah, yeah. I heard a lot of it comes down to if the singers are mic'd and what language it's in. But I don't know.
Yeah, that's true, too. That's true, too. There's a whole different type of singing, right, when it comes to operatic singing without the microphone, like you said. And musicals where maybe because they're dancing and acting and using their voice as well, that they need to be mic'd. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'm still learning that one.
So when you finished up your early career or early education and you went to Juilliard, what was your goal for Juilliard? Was it immediately to go into opera, or was it to go into just being another incredible violist? Oh, sorry.
Sure, I went to Juilliard when I was 10. I didn't go there for college. I was very
young. Gosh.
So I wasn't very ready for career yet.
That's a very different experience.
Yes. But for my undergrad at Purchase, I very much realized I wanted to be in theater. I wasn't sure if it was musical theater or just a play. I didn't quite understand or see a big difference at that time, because all the plays I ended up being in were very musical based. There was so much music from the people singing and myself being almost as an actor, because I was always in costume on stage. I had this thing where I never wanted to be a part of a pit for some reason. And I just like the responsibility of also being a part of the show and bringing another layer that's very different from what you would typically see in a play or musical.
I'm going to guess that has a lot of influence on how you wrote The Woodsman, since you got the lone violin on stage, not in a pit.
Very true. That play is really, it's my baby, and I love it so much, and I want to continue to see it grow so much. Funny, it started as a dance piece, and I don't know if many people know that or have researched that before, but it was very much a dance piece, because there's barely any words and a small prologue in the beginning. That's pretty much what it was. And the person who originally choreographed everything was a dancer from Purchase College. And we were all Purchase graduates. I mean, I was still in school at the time. I think I was a junior when I was writing this. But, everyone from James to me being the youngest person, all of us were Purchase grads. But it was a dance piece with puppets that needed some music. And it was just about a 30-minute production for a party. For one of the company's plays in a party.
How'd you get tapped in to join?
Most of the time it was through one of the actors, because I did all of their plays at their conservatory. I was like an unofficial acting conservatory major, because I was the music guy who always composed music to all the shows.
What is it like writing a full show for one instrument? That seems like it could be pretty difficult to pull off.
It was. it was really stressful at first. Some aspects of it were very emotional as well. There were even some parts where I would write something and I was like, oh, this is too good for this.
Oh no.
Yeah, some of those love themes that I love so much. I tried to imitate something from Romeo and Juliet in that opera, and that orchestral setting. And I thought that's something that could have expanded to a greater piece on its own. But it felt, it was just the perfect amount for the connection between Nimi and Nick Chopper. But I needed to explore a few different genres. Figure out how to fill up silence, because I've never played for that long before, nonstop. I think there's about maybe a 30-second break that I have throughout the entire 75-minute production that it is now.
The violin just keeps going.
It just keeps going. It's a lot of endurance, a lot of supporting what's happening in front of me, a lot of foreshadowing what's about to happen. And of course, introducing themes of each character and how they play with each other. It was kind of difficult in the beginning. James and I, we sat in a room. I think it was in Queens, and we just talked for a while about what we thought the scenes would look like, and that would already give me a lot of ideas on what the music sounds like. For some reason, if you tell me a story, I already start to hear music. It's like, oh, this is what I think it would sound nice. So he would tell me a bunch of his ideas and I would tell him mine and play for him. And that's kind of how it ended up happening. We would bounce each other's ideas off of each other. Then a script was born and then a score was born. And it's funny, throughout time, we would say, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that you're doing the three pizzicatos for the witch clicking her heels three times. Like, yeah, that's what it's for. You know, all these like little things that may or may not have been missed in the play are a reflection of what I see or have heard the idea from him. That all sounds very confusing.
I follow it pretty well. Like, it makes sense. Like, the follow-up question I had to that was, how much involvement did you have with the sound design as well and the sounds being made on stage to implement that into your, like, compositions?
That one was... That came with each addition to expanding the play. So from what I remember, it wasn't much of... for instance, the Kalita that has this very unusual sound. We didn't really develop that to what it is now until we went off Broadway, really. Before that, it was, I think maybe at Ars Nova, we kind of had something. It's a drum that has some rosin, like I use for my bow. And you pinch it with a string in the middle of the drum, and it makes this like rattling sound, along with people kind of growling like a tiger or bear or something like that. And that's what develops that eerie sound of the Kalita. So it was, that one was more of a, let's throw some ideas and try to invent this type of sound, because, you know, everything is about creating what's happening in a play live. You know, none of it was, it was sound effects. So how do we replicate this sound of this unusual mythical creature every night? Okay, let's have a drum the old-fashioned way, throw some pots and pans, see what happens. So
I'm curious about the entire process from beginning to end, from just this dance piece at a party to off Broadway and everything in between. I want to hear about that entire experience.
Sure. Like I said, it started as a dance piece. And we didn't think that it was actually going to continue afterwards. It was kind of one of those projects where it seemed like a cool idea and let's just put this on. We're all creative people. We all love each other. Why not? And then we got a very well response from the audience that wanted to see it again. So the next year we did it again. And it was the same thing. We did it for two days that time, two shows. And then, a few months later, we did the Ars Nova and then eventually 59's 59 Theaters. And I think it was more so of the response from everyone else that almost fueled our excitement for it. From the beginning, I kind of always had this thought that it should be bigger than itself. And it continues to grow, but I still kind of feel like it's almost there. Even though we've been off Broadway and there's a film about it, something about making it more operatic and making a larger set and having almost bigger things that still make it seem intimate as well. You know, it's wishful thinking that it becomes a Broadway show one day, but that's kind of what I've always hoped and put into the universe. But yeah, I think it was the response from other people, our determination and drive to tell this story, to make it very personal and bring ourselves into the play each time we've done it. Because each time we've done it, it's changed a little bit here and there. And I think that's what everyone starts to like about it and makes it real, right? All these things that we are creating that don't have life to it until we bring life to it, right? Each puppet, so beautiful, especially when the actors are those puppets, right? And they're not themselves. They are the Tin Man. They are the witch, right? And then it's also, behind the scenes, so much playing around with these puppets, so much playing around with every single idea and variation of what can be, to see what works and what doesn't work, what looks silly and what looks fun or serious, you know. And I think this play also touches on so many different emotions. So all that being said, the music always had to change as well with each addition to The script, its expansion of everything, the music also reflected what was happening, what's gonna happen. You know, every time the witch gets closer to an audience member or jumps, I have to do almost the exact same thing. I guess I don't necessarily have to, but that's what something I wanted to as a composer, right? Something I'm telling myself, that's what should happen, and whoever else plays the part. Yeah, it was just a very, after the second rendition of it, it was very much a forward direction until New World Stages and Broadway HD.
Yeah.
So my next question. Oh, sorry about that.
I'm gonna go.
Oh, Andrew,
I'm gonna go.
You
first,
go.
I think.
You go.
You might not have much insight into this, but I'm wondering if you know anything about how the puppetry and all that came about.
How it came about, like how it was created.
Yeah, like who did you get to make the puppets, and whose idea was it to do that?
Sure. That's all James Ortiz. That's his thing. He loved, from my understanding and the history I know about him before Purchase as well. I mean, he's a phenomenal actor, but he loved creating puppets, and that's what he's really into. That's what he's really known for nowadays, that and set design. So that was very much all of his idea. I want to do a puppet show, and I don't know what else to do. So then he asked other people in his company, and eventually one of the actors asked me, oh, this guy from Purchase, all Purchase people, does all his plays, does all of our plays, why don't we ask Eddie to go and write the music for the show? And that's how that happened. It's very, very quick.
Wow.
But yeah, it was all his idea about doing the puppets. And then a combination of people to figure out how to tell a story and make the puppets come to life. But he was always the person that taught everyone how to maneuver each puppet. You know, because it's very easy to, how do I describe this, to also do the motion of the puppet. Right, if you pick something up and you try to move it forward or back or make a jump, you almost want to do those things too because you're part of it, but that's not...
Yeah.
At least what I saw, it's very much of a, you know, almost like playing violin. It's an extension of yourself. That's how the puppeteers are, too. You no longer matter. You are the puppet now. And the team effort of making the puppet come to life and tell the story.
Absolutely.
My next question is about just your experience and were there any like massive hurdles that you felt were hard to come through either as a collective like creative team or you yourself as a composer?
Massive hurdles. Let's see. There were some. Well, some of them started with, which is very innocent, starting with who's in the audience, which is really funny. You know, if there's a reviewer and if the New York Times was there, no one wanted to hear anything, and that could very much affect what's going to happen on stage. I'm the person that wants to know. For some odd reason, I can also be a perfectionist, so I very much remember the day the New York Times was there because I asked one of the producers, like, who's in the audience today? It's like, the New York Times, Laura, and don't tell anyone. It's like, okay, I won't. And I tried to put my heart on a platter, you know, I tried to let it all loose, that show. I mean, with every show as well. But every show is a little different. So some of the hurdles were if the energy is low, if the weather was terrible. Most of the time we had this thing where we only did the show in the blizzard during midwinter in January. So a lot of things happened. You know, there's one day where I went there with a stomach flu and I still had to perform. And they gave me a small little sippy cup like I'm supposed to do something with that, which is really funny. but, you know, the show must continue. And, you know, still, whatever muster you transform, you click the light switch on and you perform because that's what matters. Other hurdles. I think when... Generally speaking, when a show becomes more and more successful, it's harder to hold on to the true values and why it was first created. and why you want to continue to tell that story, your story, and bring your best foot forward along with everyone else. So as the play continued, it seemed like it was harder and harder for everyone to do that. Credits going everywhere and fame's going everywhere and recognition from everyone. And it almost, my biggest worry is that it becomes commercial. You know, that becomes so repetitive that it's on autopilot, because that's not...
the show just gets too big for everyone involved.
Right. It's not... And then it takes away from the performance itself, right? It's... Every single time someone performs, like every time I play my violin, although they're small, I can't replicate exactly what happened each time. It's something different how I'm feeling. Maybe I lost something that day and I'm really sad. That's somehow incorporated into what I'm doing as well. Maybe I'm having a great day and it changes ever so slightly. But of course, you always try to tell the story of what the piece is. But if it becomes too commercial and everything is very... there's no more spark, then I guess only a few people will notice, right? If you're really a big fan, if you actually really pay attention, if you've seen it develop since, you'll see that it almost plateaus. And that was one of the big hurdles that happened at some point too. But like I said, we're always like trying to get better, and that's always the goal. You know, to put on an even better production instead of just doing older version.
Do you have a favorite song from the show?
Yes. I know everyone loves the Resting Tin Man song, and it's great. I love it so much too. But my favorite is the love theme. The love theme is from... it's used in two different songs from the album. Is it Finding Love, I think? It's the actual title is one of them. I think the other one is a part of it is in Nick Chopper as well. The title of the tracks. But it's a 16-bar phrase. I think it's 16 bars. And it's what I was talking about earlier that replicates the Romeo and Juliet one, where it's just continuous all the way into the last note. Would you like me to play it for you?
Yes, please.
Yeah, go for it.
Oh my sure. God.
I hope it's not too
I wish this was a video podcast just so you could see the giant smile across my face as that was offered.
Tell me if it's too loud. I hope it's not. But this is the entire love theme that is my favorite part of the play.
Wonderful.
I tried to play that very softly.
How much do you usually charge for your 54 and below shows? How much do you usually charge for your 54 and below shows? Because we just got a deal.
If you guys ever come to one, I'll give you a free ticket.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Eddie Hardy is the best guy ever. Oh, okay.
So that's from, like a Romeo and Juliet. Well, not from, but inspired by Romeo and Juliet.
I'll play the version I was talking about that I was inspired by. I mean, it continues and goes on further and further.
Yeah.
But that's very much what I heard, and I said, oh my goodness, that's such a beautiful theme to me. And I thought, if I can just put that somehow in the Woodsman without stealing his work, you know, I was like, I need to create something like this. And the love theme for the Woodsman came out like that.
Yeah, it's very good.
That's wonderful. Now, if we could move away from the Woodsman for just a second, and we'll return to it, I'm sure. I kind of want to talk about your other poetry-inspired things, like Nevermore and Evil Eye, like those types of pieces. I want to know the inspiration behind them and how poetry can inspire you to musically, basically.
Sure. That all started about a year ago. I was going to do this production of an Edgar Allan Poe play called 4 Days with Edgar Allan Poe. And that's no longer happening. But during that time, and me being a part of the Composer's Residency, the Con Edison Composer's Residency that I got into, I wanted to premiere those works. And it started with Nevermore. So I went to the Poe Cottage in the Bronx, and I bought some books and did a lot of research and even contacted the Edgar Allan Poe page, Facebook page, to have them help share the news, which is really great. But yeah, it was more so of, it was for the play. It's funny because growing up, I wasn't necessarily an Edgar Allan Poe. I wasn't knowledgeable about his work. You know, I was too focused on staying in the practice room and learning repertoire and, you know, trying to be a good student. So when I got older and then I did more plays, I was aware of his works, but never actually, indulged myself in them until someone presented the idea of doing a play for him. And I was like, sure, you know, I'm good at making dark themes. Why not? Let's see what happens. So the first thing I did was, of course, I read the play, but then I went on YouTube and tried to find someone reciting it, Nevermore. And I tried to just hear what type of music would accompany that. I forgot whose recording is very famous on YouTube that I listened to. But I tried to just write music to that and then not listen to it for about a week. And then have certain themes be the Raven, be Lenore, be this love connection between him and Lenore when he thinks about her, maybe. You know, it all starts, Nevermore starts with the idea of him just being in a room, right? And being very lost in thought. And I would like to think everyone is kind of like that at some point. I know I am. you're very much lost in thought, and then you have this distraction that you start to engage, but not really, because you're trying to be focused on what you're thinking about, and you think about what you relive, what it is you're thinking about, and then this disturbance enters my mind space, and I become very disturbed, right? So each part of the music ends up being a certain theme that would have developed more into a production. Instead, since the production ended up stopping, I just turned these into, for that one, a solo violin piece. And then I made it into a collection of three, where the other two were for quartets. And since I wanted to continue to expand on the other poems, yeah, that's kind of how it started and what I ended up with. A solo violin piece and then two other movements for string quartet that I had my string quartet play at my concert. And yeah, Evil Eye was the most well-received because very witty, I think that people were describing it as, which I appreciate. Yeah, and then the last piece, A Fantasy, and it ends up being a memory of the other pieces as well as its own thing. Of course, I tried to stay true to the poem, but from a classical point of view, I tried to use a lot of themes from the second and first movements, right? Almost straying away a little tiny bit from the actual narrative of the poem of the Red Death, right? Just a little bit away. to make it seem more complete as a classical piece that were inspired by his pieces, by Poe's works.
Mm-hmm. Now, which one do you think was a little bit more easy to delve into, the work of Frank Baum or the work of Edgar Allan Poe?
I think that's a hard question. It's a very hard question. I think L. Frank Baum. Poe is a little dark for me. It was a little dark. It's about finding a place that I'm not normally in to figure out what that sounds like. And it was kind of uncomfortable. It's kind of uncomfortable, especially with Nevermore. Evil Eye starts off much more hopeful and almost church-like in the piece. And then it becomes very weird. But it's very much a darker place. L. Frank Baum was more along the lines of what I was already doing, which was easier for me to tackle. There are certain parts of the piece, too, in The Woodsman, where other violinists that either used to play or still play would hear certain things that are reminiscent of Bach's sonata, like right in the beginning. It's actually very similar to one of his C major sonatas for solo violin. And only a few people actually noticed that. And it's very short. It's maybe 2 or 3 measures, but that's also what starts the whole prologue. You know, it's finding inspiration to what I like, what I know, and what I can create and expand on to create something new. So L. Frank Baum was definitely easier to dive into.
All right, my next question. Oh, I actually have 2 last questions because I know you've got a time constraint coming up pretty quick.
It's okay.
The first one is probably the most basic question that everyone's sick of hearing. What's next for Eddie Hardy?
What's next? Let's see. Surprisingly, I never thought that I wanted to be a playwright. And coincidentally, I'm actually writing a play. I'm writing a play about the past, essentially, loosely based on the last 2 years of my life. And it's kind of funny. You know, if it's something really bad that's happened, you always have to find like a funnier, lighter way of telling that story. You know, if something great, that's funny. If it's something unorthodox, that's unusual. You know, so far, let's see if I can find the exact description for you so I don't say something wrong. But the story is about a lonely subway musician who barely makes money for rent ends up being discovered by a retired comedian while finding the love of his life on an unpredictable dating app. Now, in my life, I actually found my fiance on a dating app. I play a lot in the subways. I don't have a comedian that I know, but I think my mother's pretty funny, and so am I, and a lot of people in my life. So, you know, I like to pull in different characteristics of people to create one, right? Parts of my personality create another one, link a story that has happened to me, but also making sense to what I'm saying and what I'm trying to say and show who I am. So that's actually the next thing besides performing all over the city. That's my personal project. I'm working on a new play, and it's going to be very musical, or it's going to have a lot of music in it. I'm not sure it's a musical yet, but it's very musical in that sense.
Well, let us know when that comes out. We would love to cover it on this show.
Sure.
Would you be playing yourself in this, do you think?
As of now, I would. And the comedian I reached out to, because I'm really excited and kind of giddy about all of this, because I reached out to a fellow colleague from Purchase. And I was like, man, you know, Marcus, I've always wanted to work with you. And it's going to happen one day. almost, what, 9, 10 years later? No, actually 5 years later. It's like, hey, this is the time. I wrote this part just for you. Okay, find a director. Hey, Dean, you remember we used to work together all the time? That's kind of how it's happening so far. So I feel like I'm creating a team and then still writing this play, and I'm really, really excited about it. So yeah, we'll be playing myself and trying to fill in the blanks here and there when it happens.
That's fantastic. I'm excited for this. As just a fan, I'm like, oh, that sounds great. Now my last, very last question, which is sure. Also the question that every composer hates to get, but I'm gonna ask anyway, is what is your advice to all the inspiring creatives out there that I know for a fact are listening, because me and Andrew are inspiring creatives, like, or specific, if you want me to get more specific, specifically musical theater composers or playwrights like yourself?
Sure. Advice. I think after all of my schooling, I've realized that life experience is really what ends up teaching me how to write better. And I think that you have to continue to write. Try to write every single day. If not, think about it. If not, live the experience that you want to tell one day. Trying to do any of those things without it being personable to you is going to be very difficult, from my perspective. So experience life more, write every single day, continue to learn from others, and be inspired. Always be inspired. One of my things nowadays is that I love artwork. I don't know what it's about. I love going to an art auction, even if I'm not going to buy anything, and just seeing a lot, because that also keeps my mind going and expands the horizon for me. So
I think that's good advice. That's a beautiful way to end this, like, wrap this all up. I think that was a fantastic interview that he gave. Like, he's really good at this. He's done this before, I think.
Thank you so much.
It was wonderful having you on. I'm sure there's tons of stuff you want to promote out there for yourself, so go ahead, promote it out there into the world.
Again, my name is Edward W. Hardy. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow me at Edward W. Hardy on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or my website, edwardwhardy.com. That's about it.
There's no albums you want to try to get people to buy? Like, buy the Woodsman album.
I'm still working on an album. The only album I have is the Woodsman one, and a few singles that come out here and there. But nothing in the works right now. I just have the play. If you have any recommendations on something you want me to work on, I will take that.
Well, I have plenty of ideas if you want some.
Wright Brothers musical. Make it happen.
It's happening.
Oh my gosh.
It was great having you on.
That'd be really great.
That's what I said.
That's actually something we're kind of shadow working on, is a set.
That's great. I'll love
to keep that on the down low, Jess.
That's so cool.
All right, let's do our closing remarks, Andrew, so we can wrap this all up.
All right. Well, what do you want me to say?
Well, just follow. You know how we do this. We do this once a week. Thank you guys for listening to Musicals with Cheese. Please follow us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher at Musicals with Cheese. Our Twitter is at Cheesy Musicals. Instagram musicals. Our Instagram is Musicals with Cheese. Our YouTube page is Musical Theater Lives. Please shoot us an email at musicaltheaterlives@gmail.com. Our title card was created by the amazing Jolene Casco. Her Instagram is at Jolene Casco. And Edward, do you have anything else you want to say before we wrap this all up?
No, just thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Anytime. Anytime you want to come back, let us know.
Sure. Sure.
It was wonderful having you on. It was an honor.
Thank you. Honor's mine.
All right. We'll see you next time on Musicals with Cheese.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit, that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.